I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk with two veteran Washington, D.C. political reporters with deep Hoosier connections. We're going to talk about how Hoosiers are affecting the national debate in the nation's capital and about how the federal government is working. My guests are Tom Lobianco of the Associated Press and Eric Bradner from CNN. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are broadcasting today live from the fabulous NPR studios in Washington, D.C. This place is wonderful. It's like the Starship Enterprise, and I've got to say that the folks here at NPR really knock themselves out and make us feel at home. We're going to be talking about the national political scene and really Indiana's place in it with two veteran D.C. political reporters, both of whom have serious Indiana connections, starting with Tom Lobianco, who now is with the Associated Press, which is where he did the bulk of his reporting when he was in Indiana and worked out of the State House there. And we're joined by a guy, actually, who was once a guest host on this program, Eric Bradner, who is now with CNN and before that was with the Evansville Courier and Press and was their State House bureau chief. Probably in the interest of full disclosure, I ought to report that that Eric is a former student of mine. I sincerely hope the experience did not scar him too much. Because we are in D.C., we're not able to take phone calls today, but we'd love to have you join the conversation by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, finding us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or tracking us down on Twitter at WFYI. So welcome to the show, guys. It's good to have you here, and thank you for making the time to join us. I'd like to talk a little bit just about, you know, how Indiana went from sort of being flyover country to being, you know, if not the exact center of the political universe, at least somewhere in the suburbs now. Eric, I'll start with you on that. Just could you walk through how, because there are a lot of, in addition to Mike Pence and all that, there are a lot of Hoosiers who are involved in government here, and we've got perhaps one of the hottest Senate races in the country.
Yeah, that's coming right. Up. Yeah, absolutely. And this all kind of traces back to 2008, right, when Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were competing toward the end of the Democratic presidential primary, and the two big states were Indiana and North Carolina. And Obama won North Carolina pretty handily, barely lost Indiana, but just the fact that there was so much attention on the state, so much energy in trying to win it was unique for Indiana. Then in 2008, Obama carried the state. It was probably the most surprising win of his 2008 victory. And that started a period of really interesting sort of developments that put Indiana at the forefront of the national political scene. Then you can go look at the Richard Lugar, Richard Murdoch Republican Senate primary, and you can look at Evan Bayh's sort of comeback bid for the Senate that didn't end up working out, and Mike Pence getting elected vice president after Donald Trump won the Indiana primary in 2016 in what was really the fatal blow for Ted Cruz and John Kasich, who hung on just a little bit longer, but it was kind of the nail in their coffins. So anyway, we find ourselves in an election cycle now where Joe Donnelly, the Democrat who won in 2012 after the weird, wacky primary between Lugar and Murdoch, is, if not the most endangered Senate Democrat, then certainly one of the two most endangered, along with Missouri's Claire McCaskill. So in addition to his race, there are a few congressional districts that are normally out of reach for Democrats, but that could be sort of popping onto people's radars this election cycle, because Democrats are looking at a playing field that's just absolutely huge. And Indiana's 5th congressional district is one that I think is worth watching. President Trump won it by, I think, 13 points in 2016, which is a lot, but sort of still within, you know, potentially competitive territory. It's suburban, wealthy, fairly highly educated, and these are the characteristics that make up areas that Democrats have really seen their fortunes change in special elections and in the Virginia gubernatorial election late last year. So Indiana's 9th congressional district is another one where it's worth watching to see how Trey Hollingsworth, as a freshman, fares in his reelection, where he's got sort of the Indianapolis South Side suburbs and the Louisville suburbs both in his district. So, you know, those are not districts that Democrats expect to win, but just sort of their fundamentals in this political environment suggest that they're absolutely races to watch. So anyway, there are a few other places where there are hotbeds of competitive races this year. Minneapolis is one. Las Vegas is one. Southern California, Orange County, Philadelphia. Those places are kind of used to this. Indiana is not used to it. It's really only been over the last decade or so that this has become kind of a regular thing. And the Donnelly race in particular is one where both sides see a big opportunity to define him, to actually pit, for Republicans to pick off a state that President Trump won. Democrats need to hold on to it if they have any chance at all at the Senate majority. So it's going to be very expensive. Very high stakes, and I mean, absolutely one of the I do regular Senate race rankings. Mm-hmm. I have it the 4th most likely to flip, after Arizona, Nevada, and Missouri. Mm-hmm. And you could really make an argument that it belongs anywhere in that order, the top 4. But it's certainly there.
Tom, you actually came to Indiana around the time that this, you know, the spotlight shifted in our direction, because mm-hmm. Unlike Eric, you're not a native Hoosier, but you came, what year did you arrive?
May 2011.
Yeah. So you came right before the Lugar-Murdoch race,
right.
And in the sort of the aftermath of, as Eric says, of Barack Obama's 2008 race kind of rewriting the calculations. What was your impression when you got to this state?
Well, you know, and I've told many folks out there, it's not a secret. I'm from Baltimore, mm-hmm. and I guess I reunited with my Colts. Jim Merritt used to come by the shack, and we'd always rib each other about, you know, stealing football teams and whatnot. Of course, Baltimore did
the same
our own.
Thing to my, exactly. My hometown of Cleveland.
So, oh, yeah. I apologize.
That's okay. Apparently, what goes around comes around. So,
I mean, you know, I love state politics. And I tell everybody this. I came up covering Maryland politics. I used to cover the Martin O'Malley. When he was governor for a number of places. I like state houses. I have a lot of fun there. And Indiana has this wonderfully rich, dynamic political environment where if you are inside the I-95 bubble or the West Coast bubble or any other bubble for that matter, you have no idea about any of this. But there are these great, rich, deep connections. And I'm doing this reporting for the book on Mike Pence. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've been discovering is how deep and how far the Dan Quayle network extends. Because we think about strong Republican networks in Indiana. I mean, it's Richard Lugar. Mm-hmm. He gave us Mitch Daniels. You know, everyone out here thinks of Richard Lugar. Quayle had a power in and of himself, and stretching out of Northeast Indiana.
Well, Dan Coats, Greg Zeller.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And to me, I mean, just as a political junkie, I love it because there's always new things. There are always new things to discover. There are always these new connections to see. And I think what's fascinating to your original question when you opened the show about what's happening here in Washington with Indiana. You know, Trump, when he came in, is kind of a neophyte, novice, however you want to put it, but he didn't have a network. So a lot of this is the adopted Pence / Daniels / Lugar / Indiana network. And it's not just, remember that Pence, when he was governor, he did not have a broad network. Daniels had a baked-in network of supporters.
Yeah, he was a much more direct heir of Richard Lugar's.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Pence didn't have that. So it's not strictly Pence. You have a lot of the Republican donor class out of Indiana that's very powerful out here. They've kind of grown into power. Remember Marty Obst used to – came out of Ballard World. He had been involved with Pence's first run, then was not involved in Pence's first run. He kind of got out of it somehow in 2011, 2012. Then he came back for 2015. He's not what anyone would call a Pence loyalist. You know, he's not like a Kellyanne Conway or Mark Short, somebody with deep, deep connections. But here he is, and he's part of this fabric now, of this administration. So a lot of it is the opportunities that were presented by a political neophyte like Trump coming in and not having those deep connections. I mean, these people all came here, and there are so many Indiana connections in Washington.
Mm-hmm. Just throughout the entire administration, I mean, from Mark Short, the White House's top lobbyist on the Hill, to Kellyanne Conway, and then through the agencies. I mean, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services director is Seema Verma, who was Mitch Daniels' healthcare policy consultant, and then Mike Pence's healthcare policy consultant. So you see those sorts of Indiana connections throughout the entire Trump administration for exactly the reason.
Well, even when we were out here last year about this time, actually it was a little earlier in the year, we were doing similar show with Richard Lugar. And in the course of that, you know, the word came down that Dan Coats was going to be appointed, so that we actually had to pivot and do some news and get Lugar's reaction to that, which is not something you've got to figure would have been on the radar screen if a Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio or somebody like that. Real quickly, Tom, you alluded to a book. You've signed a deal to write a book about Mike Pence, right?
Yep. So,
who's the publisher?
Doing a biography of Mike Pence for HarperCollins, the Day Street imprint, and just piecing together everything in his life, Columbus, his early start in politics, everything up through here, up through where we are right now. And, I mean, he's a hugely critical political personality figure, because of where he is right now, because of the president, because of where we are in this country right now. I mean, we could, 1 year from now, it's entirely possible we could be in the beginning of impeachment proceedings. That's not out of the question. And I mean, Eric knows that better than anybody watching at the ground level these House races. So we're covering everything. We're going deep. We're going long. And I think there's – I'm not going to give away everything, but there's more to the story on him. And it's fascinating. He might come off as kind of boring and a little bit white bread and whatnot in, you know, in public. I think he's a fascinating character.
How did you know, those of us who have lived in Indiana and all of that sort of know Mike Pence – how much of this is going to be also about just trying to explain who this guy is to the rest of the country and to some degree explain what Indiana is to the rest of the country?
Well, that's a hard thing. You know, it's you have to be immersed in it. I'll say this about him, and I think this is true perhaps more than other politicians. When we write these books, you know, when people do this, everyone's always looking for like the golden anecdote. You know, they're looking for the one that explains everything. And, you know, Lord knows there's enough of those on
Orson
Trump.
Orson Welles and Citizen Kane and Rosebud. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, you're looking for one. I don't think that's what works with him. I think that you need 1,000 anecdotes to come to a few basic truths about who he is, how he's developed over the years. We're not the same person that we were, He was 28 when he first ran for Congress. He's at 58, 59 now. That's 30 years ago. You're not the same person. You develop, you change. And the big question at the end of this, and the big question that I got from the publisher when we were discussing this was, how would he lead if he were president? And I hope that all that information leads up to an answer to that question for everyone who reads this.
We are talking with two veteran Washington political reporters, Tom LoBianco of Associated Press and Eric Bradner of CNN, about Indiana's role in national politics now and really where the nation is. We're broadcasting live from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Because of that, we're not able to take phone calls, but we hope you'll join the conversation by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, finding us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or tracking us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today live from NPR's fabulous studios in Washington, D.C. We're talking with two veteran political reporters here, Tom LoBianco of the Associated Press and the former guest host of No Limits, Eric Bradner of CNN. Before this, we were sort of talking about how Indiana emerged as this national force in politics. I'd like to talk a little bit, I think we've got to, in the aftermath of the government shutdown and all of that, in part because I spent most of the morning talking with Richard Lugar and the people around him for a documentary that we're doing. And we talked quite a bit about why government just doesn't seem to work anymore, why we have, if not shutdowns, all of these frequent near misses. I'm going to start with Tom on that one. But what has changed? Because I think a lot of people are out there who don't live politics the way we do and are wondering, okay, how did we get to this point? Why does it not function?
Before we do that, can I offer a
sure.
plug for the book for
sure.
anyone who's listening to this? Find me on Twitter. My email is simple, tomlobianco@gmail.com. Find me on Twitter. My direct messages are open. Contact me. Give me, you know, if you got stories, if you grew up with him in Columbus, if you worked with him in his early legal career in Indy, tell me about it. I want to hear everything. These are the 1,000 anecdotes that will tell the truth of him. So,
okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Everything but an 800 number. It sounds like you've got going there.
Oh, I forgot okay. to give the 800 number.
Okay. So how did we get to this point?
Well, it's complex, right? It's this polarization that we've seen for, you know, 3 decades now. It's been growing constantly. Is it gerrymandering? I think gerrymandering plays a huge part in that. I'm also a little skeptical how much of this is new per se. I kind of think of the World War II, post-World War II era as a sort of a fluke in bipartisanship in American history because of shifting demographics. We had this with Kennedy to Johnson to Nixon. You had a flip of the South in terms of political alliances.
Over the civil rights.
Exactly.
Movement, yeah.
So I think – I'm not sure how much of this is new per se in U.S. history versus how much of this we just haven't seen in modern U.S. history. What we do know is that it is just incredibly exacerbated. I mean, look at this deal that happened. The deal gets us to February 8th. So what's today, the 23rd?
So we got 2 weeks.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, we can be – yeah, come back again in 2 weeks and we'll do this all over again, right?
Yeah.
Have they moved the ball forward on the key issue at hand, immigration? No. By all accounts, it doesn't look like they've gotten anywhere other than agreeing to have a debate on it, which is, weren't you having a debate on it before?
Mm-hmm.
So all of these things contribute to just perpetual gridlock. And I was listening to I think it was Amy Walters was on the radio recently, just brilliant political mind. She knows all this stuff granularly.
Mm-hmm.
And She was saying that what you have is like a ping pong effect, where every cycle, when you have these wave cycles, which is what appears to be happening in 2018 with the Democrats now as opposed to the Republican wave, is the voters are just pissed off at government generally. Mm-hmm. And they're constantly looking for whoever says they have a new answer. And when they don't deliver on that answer, then they go out and they kick them out however they can. And so 2016 was the Republicans' turn for the answer, mm-hmm. the immediate answer. We are now into 2018. They have not delivered on certain things like health care. That's why it was so important for them to deliver politically on tax reform and hear something on immigration. So it looks like going forward, unless you have some major changes in how districting is done, mm-hmm. Major changes in how people are elected to the House, it's not going to change. I mean, we could be doing the shutdown dance in perpetuity for another 20 years.
Yeah, wave elections are the norm now, right, mm-hmm. in the midterm cycle. 1994 was a wave election. 1998 and 2002 were elections that took place after major national events that dominated mm-hmm. news and attention. So they're sort of abnormal. But then 2006 was a wave election. 2010 was a wave election. 2014 was sort of a wave election. This is what happens. This is mm-hmm. just sort of where we are.
It's the new norm.
And part of it is, of course, and this is something that I think people understand now, sort of an incentive structure that rewards politicians for running to their bases. Mm-hmm. But it's also a product of changing demographics, the changing demographics of the parties mm-hmm. and their bases. Democrats are more and more reliant on minority voters, younger voters, women, and Republicans are more and more reliant on exurban and rural voters who are overwhelmingly white, mm-hmm. Many of whom don't have college degrees. And the 2016 election sort of demonstrated that. But even more so since then, we've seen special elections and 2017 elections where minority turnout in particular was through the roof. Mm-hmm. I mean, Black women elected Doug Jones in Alabama. That they're mm-hmm. the reason that he's a senator and Roy Moore is not. Mm-hmm. Latino turnout has been very high. And that's a reaction to Donald mm-hmm. Trump, the Trump presidency. But it's also sort of the emerging coalition that Democrats see as their future. It's as Republicans are sort of on the rise in the Rust Belt, with Ohio and Iowa kind of leaving swing state territory, and Wisconsin and to a lesser extent Minnesota wandering their way into that territory. Democrats see their future in Sun Belt states like mm-hmm. Arizona, Georgia, Texas to an extent. Texas was closer in 2016 than Ohio was. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's sort of a trend of like who makes up the base in each party, and that changes what the parties need to respond to, especially Democrats. It's why so many members of the party were willing to go to the wall for a DACA deal. Mm-hmm. And
I see there's just some breaking news that Chuck Schumer withdrew the offer on the wall.
Yeah.
So we're seeing now the new dynamic is going to be, okay, you don't give us DACA, you don't get your wall.
Well, and politically, I mean, there's an argument for Democrats to make that is it realistic in this Congress to just say protecting the Dreamers is politically popular, therefore we're not going to give you anything. You just have to do it. Mm-hmm. Or else we'll shut down the government. I mean, that it's not feasible, but protecting the Dreamers is very politically popular. Mm-hmm. Democrats are sort of right that position, stripped of the context of tying it to government funding, is something that it's politically wise for them to fight for, not just because it's popular with their base, but because it's popular with voters everywhere. Except for the voters who are never going to support Democratic candidates. But anyway, that sort of leads to this exacerbation of the problem of not being able to strike a deal on anything or fund the government beyond a month at a time. So, so February 8th, we'll find ourselves right here again.
Again.
Can I throw in a wild card here? There is one wild card that there's many wild cards, but one wild card that I think is fascinating is that we're going to see a debate soon in public over earmarks. Mm-hmm. Remember earmarks struck down in 2011 with the Republican wave that took the House? And now you have this – it might be the only bipartisan thing happening in the Capitol right now. You have Steny Hoyer sitting down, the Democratic whip, sitting down with leadership for Republicans, Paul Ryan, trying to figure out, okay, how do we debate this? Is this something that returns? And earmarks are, pork barrel spending, the flip side of that coin, however you want to call it. It's lube. Mm-hmm. It's grease. That is how you actually get the gears moving again. I mean, just from a purely political standpoint, if you have somebody on the fence in a Florida swing district, a Republican or a Democrat, or you have – I'll give you a good example of this. So I'm from Maryland, and Governor Larry Hogan, a moderate Republican, is facing re-election again. And I was over the weekend with a few friends. Their families from the Eastern Shore of Maryland, which is very conservative, very rural, which is a rarity in Maryland. It's Maryland. I always consider to be Indiana through the looking glass. It's the flip side of Indiana. Indiana's primarily rural with some urban centers. Maryland is the opposite. The Eastern Shore is dominated by Republicans. There's a family down there that's friend's family who's very liberal. They hate Donald Trump with a passion. They don't particularly like Republicans. However, they're big fans of the governor. Why? Because he's the guy that brought them a visitor center to their little town on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. It's a deliverable. I mean, if you can go back to getting deliverables.
So it gets back to something resembling constituent service and also bringing the bacon back to.
Exactly.
And this is the life cycle on Capitol Hill. I mean, Jeff Flake, the Arizona senator, was a House outsider, crusader against earmarks, led the fight to abolish them. Darling of the Club for Growth types, outside groups. Part of the insurgency, whatever you want to call it. Now, here we are in 2018, and he's being run out of town for being too establishment. He's such a figure of the establishment that he's retiring this year because he admits there's no way he could have won the Republican primary.
But not closing the door to running for president.
Well, right. That sort of accelerated change in how Washington works and what people actually care about and that sort of thing is sort of a symptom of this this bigger picture where everybody wants to throw everything out all the time.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with two veteran political reporters, Tom LoBianco and Eric Bradner, about the national political scene. If you want to join the conversation, we're broadcasting live also from the fabulous studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. We can't take calls, but you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So I've seen what I thought was one of the best kind of explanations of what is going on at this moment, because most of the wave elections that Eric referenced really were Republican waves. You had only 2006, really.
Right.
And someone broke it down and said, basically, the Democrats generally have an advantage in numbers. Republicans generally have an advantage in intensity. And part of what is going on right now is that, large part because of Donald Trump, the intensity gap has closed, that he has motivated other parts of the base. Can you speak to the validity of that and what are some of the signs we're seeing there?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And one thing that I think is interesting, sorry to go down a little bit of a side route here, but Republican base voters typically turn out to vote because in terms of the demographics, they're older and have been voting longer. Once a new population, Latinos in the Southwest, for example, once they register to vote and vote once, they tend to keep voting. And so part of this is sort of new groups of voters that are sort of being added to the pool. So that's a factor that this sort of cycle that we're seeing right now where there's such backlash to Donald Trump, that's something that could have tangible effects for decades. But anyway, we are absolutely seeing much more intensity with Democratic voters, with progressive voters, especially minority populations. Several examples of this. I mean, we saw it in the Virginia and New Jersey gubernatorial elections in November. We saw it again in December in Alabama. And we also are seeing it in terms of just the engagement of groups like Indivisible, which has launched chapters in every congressional district on the map and is hosting what they call empty chair town halls, where even if the Republican congressman or congresswoman doesn't show up, they still do an event, often attended by a Democratic member of Congress from a nearby district. Over and over and over, we've been seeing signs that the Democratic base is turning out in record numbers for a midterm. We just saw a special election in Wisconsin for a state Senate seat that had gone for President Trump by 16 points in 2016, and that the Democratic candidate just won by 11 points. Scott Walker, the Republican governor of Minnesota.
Or Wisconsin.
Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Basically had a heart-to-heart with other Wisconsin Republicans on Twitter, mm-hmm. where he said over and over that they were taking for granted the idea that they've been in charge in Wisconsin for a while, and that voters understand what they've done, what they've accomplished, and will continue to reward them for it in this political environment dominated by President Trump. That's obviously not the case. And Walker talked about that at a National Governors Association meeting in the fall that I was at, too. Rick Scott, the governor of Florida, who's thinking about a Senate run in another one of these diverse states where Democratic enthusiasm could really sort of change the game, has also kind of seemed much more hesitant to be on the ballot. He's thinking about a Senate run this year, but that's a looming factor there. So we've seen Republicans admitting that this is something that they're afraid of, that they're thinking about, and that they are looking for ways to counter and to sort of change the conversation to get it away from Donald Trump and onto literally almost anything else.
And what forms, Tom, do you think are we going to see of this trying to change the subject or divert attention?
I'll give you another home story. I like these home anecdotes. My longtime neighbor, family friend growing up was talking with her about this. And they, you know, when I go home, talk to family, they always ask me about Trump. They ask me about the Russia investigation, politics, whatnot. Moderate Republican hates Trump, also hates Nancy Pelosi.
Mm-hmm.
This, I think, you don't have to do anything new here, per se. You can just run the same ads that you ran for the last decade, because Nancy Pelosi is the leader of the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm not saying that, you know, she should be branded as a villain, but she has been branded as a villain. It's already happened. The groundwork has already been laid.
That's totally true. There's a special election in a Pittsburgh area congressional district right now where all of the Republican ads are
focused on
Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah,
Nancy
focused
Pelosi.
On Nancy.
Even though the Democratic candidate says he wouldn't even vote for Nancy Pelosi for speaker.
Yep.
Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah. That's 100% it. I still get email. I get Trey Gowdy's campaign emails. I mean, boom, Pelosi. you don't have to do – if it's not broke, why fix it?
Yeah, use it as punctuation.
Exactly.
And all of that. We are talking about the national political scene and Indiana's place in it, expanded place in it, on No Limits today. We're broadcasting live from NPR studios in Washington, D.C. My guests are Eric Bradner of CNN and Tom Lobianco of the Associated Press. We're not able to take calls today, but we'd love to have you join the conversation by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, finding us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or tracking us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today live from the fabulous NPR studios in Washington, D.C., with two veteran political reporters, Tom LoBianco of the Associated Press and Eric Bradner of CNN. Because we're in D.C., we're not able to take calls, but you can join the conversation by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, finding us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or tracking us down on Twitter at WFYI. So in terms of looking at this, as Eric has said, well, Tom, too, there's going to be a massive amount of money and attention flowing into Indiana, at the very least because of the Senate race, and we're already seeing the primary there. I'd call it mud wrestling, but that probably is unfair to mud wrestling, has gotten really, really ugly really early. And these are from people who, at least in theory, agree with each other. Where do you see this going? I'll start with Eric on that.
Well, the Republican primary in Indiana is I mean, it's ugly. I don't know. You know, I don't know what to say. I mean,
it's vicious.
Yeah, it's there are a lot of interesting elements at play here, right? But yeah, these guys basically vote the same way on everything. Todd Rokita and Luke Messer, at least, and really the sort of conversation driver about Todd Rokita is that he's and I say this not to insult him, but based on the reporting that the Associated Press and the Indianapolis Star and other news outlets have done, he's a jerk, right? And so that actually makes me a bit more interested in him as as a candidate, because this is a knife fight, right? And it's going to be a close, brutal primary, and whoever wields a knife a little bit better could have an advantage. I think that's why Democrats looking at the race might ever so slightly prefer to run against one
actually,
of the other candidates.
That makes it sound more genteel than it,
well,
it's more like they've both broken off beer bottles in the alley.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And they're going
right
at each other.
It's, yeah, yeah. Whatever, like the closest anecdote we can use, like the closest comparison to a nasty fight without like crossing the line, like that's where we ought to go, right?
Yep.
So, I don't know where it's going to go. I think National Republicans looking at this race, they kind of wanted Susan Brooks to run, and she's not, and they don't see a huge difference between Rokita and Messer, because they do, they vote the same way. They both have a history of some electoral success in Indiana, but there's not a big difference in terms of the kinds of ads that Republicans would run to back either candidate against the guy that they're going to call every day between now and November, Mexico Joe. So it's hard to tell.
Is there a danger? I mean, they're both, and I'll throw this one to Tom. Is there a danger because it's very clear they're both really pursuing those Donald Trump voters,
right?
To the degree that almost anyone else is being shut out. And we did a show last week with Peter Rustoven, who was a Republican candidate for U.S. Senate 20 years ago and was associate counsel in Ronald Reagan's White House. And he said that, you know, at that point, there are maybe 20% of Republicans in the state. Not a huge number, but they can be deciders who have moved into the category of never Trump, and that means never Trump enablers too, that you can scramble so far in that direction that you can't get back.
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple of things, and we watched the special elections at the state level, national level that have happened. I think there's one sort of truism that we can draw from that over the last year of Trump, which is that I think only Trump gets Trump voters. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure they move as a block to glom onto any other candidate. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a little danger in painting it as a 100% movement onto mm-hmm. any one candidate or another. Now that said,
it was sort of the same way with Obama too.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, they're dynamic characters. You know, it's a little hard to translate that completely. However, that said, there is a big fight behind the scenes to be the Trump candidate. Mm-hmm. And I think the key difference that you see between Rakita and Messer, beyond this just unbelievable knife fight, as mm-hmm. I mean, it was just mm-hmm. when you're a journalist, I mean, you live for this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, but beyond that, you see some fighting behind the scenes over who gets which endorsements. And you see a lot of the quote-unquote establishment, donor class, government officials, the Senate President David Long, mm-hmm. You know, all these folks who are kind of the official class of Republican have largely lined up with Luke Messer. Rakita does not have that. I don't know whether that helps or hurts either one of them. I don't know how that – I think that's a big question how that translates. Remember, Trump, I think the last polling I saw was even in Indiana in job approval and negatives. Mm-hmm. I mean, normally when you're at about 50, your negatives are kind of low. Mm-hmm. All right. But they're about even. I think it's like 48, 49. I forget where I saw that. I don't think we can – the old dynamics that we always use, the trusted dynamics that we apply, our barometers of determining things, I don't think we can use them anymore. I just don't – I'm not sure how much they translate. And then let me throw another wild card in there. You have the self-funder, Mike Braun, who's mm-hmm. Using Jamestown Associates, which is one of the big Trump vendors. They're big in the Murdoch race. That's another dynamic in play. Once you start to dilute the primary field, then you start to have the potential for a third candidate to run away with it. You know, if Brooks had gotten in, I think this would – I think she would have won the general but might not have won the primary.
Mm-hmm.
And if she didn't win the primary, she'd be out of a job.
Yeah.
So it's anybody's ballgame right now, I guess is what I'm saying.
We've gotten an email that's a little bit on point to this from our regular listener, Ben. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us a message via Facebook at No Limits WFYI, track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or do what Ben did and send us an email at nolimits@WFYI.org. Says this is a rhetorical question for your panelists regarding political climate. Said, President Trump's election seems to have galvanized voters' interest in politics. But what happens when Trump is no longer president? And more importantly, what happens to voter interest if our next president is part of the establishment? Donald Trump is an easy target for never-Trumpers like myself. But in my opinion, it's only because he combines policy with his brazen disregard for decency and decorum. The blue tsunami that I keep hearing about could largely be due to the Republican Party falling lockstep behind Trump. In short, it seems like it all hinges on Trump. What happens when a boring politician becomes our next president and we're no longer distracted with our disgust for his or her character? As we've learned from media coverage about Oprah Winfrey's Golden Globe speech, public attention largely hinges on who our next president will be, with much less regard for state and local elections. Yet those are the arenas where legislation affects us the most.
It's a scathing but fair critique of the American political landscape. I would make the point, and maybe it's this is driven in part by Trump, but in part by policy. Last year, we saw a ton of Democratic energy around protecting Obamacare, around mm-hmm. the healthcare battle. That wasn't just about President Trump, and it wasn't just about trying to beat Republicans in Congress. That was because healthcare is something that people understand. They understand the sort of pocketbook impact. They understand the difference between being able to afford going to the doctor when they're sick and not. And people cared about that debate. That was something that we saw a ton of interest in. We saw protests over it. people turning out at Republican town halls the way they did back in 2009 when Obamacare was first part of the political conversation. And I think the fact that we saw it in 2009 and saw it again in 2017 suggests that healthcare policy at least is one area that people are going to care no matter who's sitting behind the desk.
I've gotten another email from a listener named Catherine. And again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Catherine writes about how she was a voice in establishing Hendricks County Voices for Change in response to the inability of either party in Indiana to govern in a way that works best for Hoosiers. She moves on and asks a question: can you discuss the implications of the Indiana GOP Senate primary and the 4th District primary? The players are Todd Rokita, Luke Messer, the Braun brothers, and various other wannabes. The winner of the Senate primary may affect who gets tagged for the 4th District, and considering how unpopular Rokita is, even among his fellow Republicans, I believe that he is not necessarily a shoe-in for that seat. Thank you. It's interesting. Clearly not a Todd Rokita fan.
Yeah, writing here. Right.
Should say that, yeah.
Which one is that? That's I think Diego Morales is running in that seat for Rokita's current seat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a fascinating dynamic at play, and I hate to be a little Pence heavy here.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a lot of talk around here about whether there's a Pence dynasty being built. Remember, his brother is running for his old seat.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of support for Greg Pence there inside the Republican Party. Just a few districts over in the 4th District, Diego Morales, who used to work inside the governor's office, very close with Pence, is running for that seat as well. You know, how much do these things transfer? How much do they translate? It's hard to tell. It's hard to tell at this point. These wave elections, they ripple down.
Mm-hmm.
Don't discount the ability of, you know, it could take away the Republican supermajority in the House, possibly even the Indiana State Senate. I'm sorry, the Indiana House and the Indiana Senate.
Which would have to be a tsunami to get to those levels. Yeah. But yeah.
Well, supermajority you could dent away at.
Yeah.
And it's worth noting that in Virginia, where Republicans held 66 out of 100 seats, they now have 51 out of 100 after.
And that came down to pretty much a coin flip.
Yeah. It literally was I was there for it. It was a lot draw. They put the candidates' names inside film canisters, which I don't know where you get film canisters anymore. And then they drew them out of a bowl. Like, that's how control of the Virginia House got decided. But anyway.
Well, there's that plaque in the Indiana House that's is dedicated to the split government, 50-50.
Yeah.
And it's incredible. I remember I was reading through these old news clips for the Pence book, and I think it might have been Maureen Grappi actually wrote a story about this back in 01 when the Senate was split, and talking about how Tom Daschle was referring back to Indiana's management under a split government. And it's an even number. These things are not out of the question. Waves move big numbers. It's an off year. You can't count on the same amount of participation that you get in a presidential. I think that there could be a lot of surprises in 10 months.
Yeah, I mean, the suburban districts are the ones to watch, even in the state legislature and in Congress. Even if Republicans have a history of winning those districts big, that's where we're seeing the most movement in terms of people that voted Republican in 2016 and are voting Democratic now. The 4th district is frankly not one that I'm terribly familiar with, because I think Trump won it by 34 in 2016. So
one would figure that's a safe margin.
Right.
Yeah,
so,
But
Diego Morales is a super interesting guy. I don't know the other candidates there. I know there are other candidates, but
So let me ask this, because we're starting to get toward the end of the program. There's obviously just the inherent fascination for those of us who are interested in politics and all of that. What do you think the lasting impact for people in Indiana is going to be for the fact that it has moved closer to center stage when it comes to these national discussions and national decision making? I'll give Tom first word and Eric last word on that.
Well, I want to talk about a sort of an axis flip in terms of how we divide things, how we view political divisions. I saw this first. The populist tones of 2016, where it took a lateral cut and turned it into a horizontal divide. And I remember watching this with the education fights that were happening between Glenda Ritz and Mike Pence, because Common Core, issues like that, Common Core united the Tea Party and the teachers' unions. That was the craziest thing I ever saw. And if you look at it on its face, you're like, well, what the hell are these people doing together, working together? And what you're doing is you're taking the way you split it and you're flipping it 90 degrees, you're rotating it, and now it's a populist versus elite, or however you want to call it, establishment versus insurgent. I think that is the lasting impact of all this. I think Trump carried that. You know, things could have been different. There's the whole Bernie would have won meme, you know? Bernie would have been carrying that too, because it predates them. They were riding that wave. And I think it's still there. This goes to the educated, college-educated women voters. That's going to be reflective of this. The moving of the Rust Belt away from Democrat into Republican hands, that's part of it. Those are lasting changes.
Eric.
Yeah, I think Tom's absolutely right. But I also think in Indiana specifically, the last decade or so has seen such a dramatic change in leadership in both parties. The figures like Richard Lugar and Mitch Daniels, who dominated with Republicans, are off the stage. Mike Pence is on a different stage. In the Democratic Party, Evan Bayh was the gorilla, and now he's gone. So both parties are represented by relative newcomers in the House and the Senate and even in the governor's office. And who emerges as someone who can build the next kind of network, like we were talking about, Dan Quayle, Richard Lugar, which turned into Mitch Daniels, is going to play a big role in deciding how Indiana Indiana politics and Indiana governments shapes up in the years to come. And I don't think we know what the answer to that question is going to be. I don't think we know who's going to emerge as a long-term sort of dominant voice, or somebody who will sort of train the next generation of leaders. And seeing who that is going to be fascinating.
Real quick, Tom, when does your book on Mike Pence come out?
Publication date yet to be determined. I do know my deadline. It's October.
It's October. And do you have a working title, or is it?
We're just calling it Pence
right now.
That could change. I guess it could change if depending upon how November turns out.
Okay. Well, I want to thank both of you guys and just ask real quickly, you miss this Indiana stuff, don't you?
All the time.
It's of good course. Having you back with us in the studio. I'd like to thank my guests, Tom Longbianco of Associated Press and Eric Bradner of CNN. Also like to thank the fabulous folks here at NPR's Washington Studios, where we've been broadcasting. We're going to be broadcasting again from here on Thursday, when we're going to be talking with former Indianapolis First Lady Bev Hudnut about life with her late husband, Indianapolis Mayor Bill Hudnut, and life without him since he passed away about a year ago. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.